one of the things monks suffer from. It's attainment anxiety. So you're supposed to get enlightened, right? So that's the program. Anyway, at a point like this in the retreat, I'm always afraid to give more information because you get overload, right? So then I just muck about. I use questions. Questions are good. Anyway, there's kind of many ways we find in literature where people speak of our spiritual possibility. Here's one from Rumi. In the last mercy of love, agonies will crowd from all directions to drag you into the directionless. Have you ever read Eckhart Tolle's Enlightenment? He gets to the point of almost being suicidal and depressed, if I remember correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong. And he has the question, and he thinks, I'm going to kill myself. And then it comes up, who's going to kill who? And that question, he just drives that question to enlightenment, or whatever, realization. He has some kind of realization, I think. I don't know. So there's that. Have you ever read the... Anyway, so go back to that. In the last mercy of love, Rumi's great, isn't he? In the last mercy of love, agonies will crowd from all directions to drag you into the directionless. Not necessarily. He might have also shot himself. but if you read the enlightenment, say, of Ramana Maharshi, his story, I collect enlightenment stories because I'm in the business, right? Same kind of thing, 17 years old. Not particularly a religious person. The only thing special his brothers said about him was that, because they shared a bed, and he'd push his brother was older, he'd push Sri Ramana off the bed, and Sri Ramana would bounce on the floor and still sleep. So he had some deep samadhi there. Same thing, he has this, all of a sudden this question comes up, I'm going to die. And who dies? And he takes that and he almost goes into rigor mortis and takes that question, for like 18 hours, I think, of just pure high beam concentration on that question, and attains some realization, which he holds for the rest of his life in a sustained and moral and good way, and goes down to Tiruvannamalai in South India and is just in samadhi, in states of samadhi, in and out of samadhi, very similar to when you read about the life of the Buddha, and then just stays there the rest of his life. Gets around in a diaper and all of India comes to him. If you see pictures of him, he's just got this diaper on. And, just a dhoti, whatever they call it. Dhoti. Something like that, right? But it looks like a diaper. He's just like present to everyone, and he's on his bench and talking to people. He's sleepy, he falls asleep for a couple hours, gets up, totally unselfconscious, and affected all of India. In a very, very profound way. Same thing, he just took that question of self and just, and that's not thought, that's not an analysis, he just took it, so much power of focus, and so that we would call good karma. So some beings are very, very, very ripe and they have some, one of the great tabla players of the Khan family was asked, how long did it take you to learn the tabla? He said, lifetimes. Mm-hmm. It's only a different Asian, Indian perspective of looking at things. So you do find beings who have this powerful capacity to concentrate, and to focus on that spiritual question of self or ego or whatever. You've read Kafka? This really surprised me. You, what metamorphosis, right? And the castle, and what was that one? The trial? Can you think of more, anything more depressing than that? But this is his. You don't need to leave your room. Just sit at your desk and listen. Don't even listen, just wait. Don't even wait. The world will offer itself to you to be unmasked. It has no choice but to roll in ecstasy at your feet. I said, well, that doesn't sound like it's different than what I read. So, you know, we human beings have these different, you know, potentials and levels of possibility. And then there's you and I. The average garden variety meditator, kind of slogging away on the cold face, and but whatever it is, I think what's deeply significant maybe about our lives is that we have an aspiration. Otherwise we wouldn't be bearing with this hour after hour of watching your mind and trying to meditate, and I think that is to be applauded, that rather than just I was just trying to encourage people. I said, great, you know, go for it. So sometimes we can be very judgmental about our, you know, the quality of our meditation, and maybe feel disheartened because the mind yet again, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, the fact is that we do aspire to something very good and very wholesome, and we have a strong ethical sense. And, these are very wholesome things. And, you know, whatever karma we have, that's what you got to work with, obviously. That's what you got to work with. So in terms of meditation, we're really working, if you take the Noble Eightfold Path, if you get right understanding and right intention down, and those are very, very important to understand what the project is, as I say, then you're working with right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And right in this sense is not absolutist. It's right in the sense that it is productive of liberation from suffering. It's not self-righteous or the Buddhist way is right and everyone else is wrong. It's not that kind of right. And so in terms of right effort, classically, it's to sustain wholesome states of mind that have arisen, to manifest wholesome states of mind that have not yet arisen. Simple enough. So maybe I have a good metta practice that is quite good. It gets me into my heart. Keep doing it. Just keep making that stronger. Maybe I don't do enough yoga, which is very true. It'd be good if I picked that up. That's simple enough. And then on the unwholesome side, to abandon unwholesome states of mind that have arisen. So there's a sense of giving up or abandonment or letting go. So if my mind is just kind of complaining about something, give it up, let go. And then to prevent unwholesome states of mind from arising that have not arisen. So if I have a good ethical life, good boundaries, keep those, because that'll prevent unwholesome things from arising. They're very simple, very, very simple. Right concentration, a lot of people ask about that, and so there's all kinds of views and opinions, but basically what do we have to do? You have to stay here. That's hard enough, isn't it? Just staying in the present here and now. So that means what? That means learning how to go away from a lot of the thinking. Learning how to be in no thought, sustaining no thought, that's quite difficult. And in terms of energy, learning how to bring enough vitality that you're really with your body, you're really with the moment, so in a way which isn't forceful. So that's a lesson you have to learn. Non-becoming, non-resistance, this kind of language. So if you pick up a meditation object, does it help you stay in the present moment? Do you have a meditation object that can help you stay in the present moment? or does it make you tight? What kind of meditation object? Are you conversant with no thought? Most of us are conversant with thought because we're constantly having conversation. But actually, like no thought, the space between thought, that's very hard, isn't it? Hard to train. So these are simple enough. In the text, you hear, you know, 1st jhana, 2nd jhana, 3rd jhana, these very high states of mind, and they can be, obviously they're important, but what is it pointing to? Like in terms of ordinary language rather than scriptural language, present moment awareness, staying in the present moment, stillness, open-heartedness, these kinds of things. So if you get those principles down, I think in terms of effort and concentration, then you kind of see where you have to work. So you're always just, and then the third factor is right mindfulness. And right mindfulness is really a mindfulness which is imbued with wisdom and understanding rather than just a kind of perfunctory presence. So as you're meditating and you're, you take stock of who you are, where you're at right now, and just really get good at letting go and abandoning the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome. And a lot of that is like the playing of a musical instrument, you know, it becomes visceral. It's something in your body that you learn to do rather than just being some kind of idea. And practice, you just have to, you know, it's like Ajahn Sona says, you need quantity time. Not just quality time, you know. I'll do a good meditation every month. It's, you know, the mind just takes, because the mind's a habitual kind of animal, isn't it? And if it runs in unskillful habits, that's the way it's going to run. So it needs, one needs to do the training. But the way the training really works is if you're interested in it. And I think that's the real heart of samadhi, is interest. If I'm interested in something, I can stay focused on it. Yeah. So if it's just a duty or a forcefulness, or that won't work. But if you're really interested, so Sri Ramana, he's really interested in this question. So interested that he wouldn't move away from it. Or Eckhart Tolle or whatever. So just that, just being interested in why do I suffer? Being interested in the breath. And your interest you have to cultivate according to your own character.